Welcome to Social Distance Central. Wait, that's what this is now? You're on Sportsnet 650. Here's Bit Nizar and Brendan Batchelor.
Welcome to Social Distance Central, the show with the COVID name. It's not about COVID. During the COVID era, I am Bit Nizar. With me is the voice of your Vancouver Canucks on Sportsnet 650, Brendan Batchelor. We're back. What's going on, Batch?
Not too much. How are you today, Bick? Missed you yesterday.
I did too. Jamie Dodd doing a great job filling in as you were filling in on Reach Deep for 3 hours there. But we missed a bit yesterday talking to Greg Wyshynski and getting set now. And we have a lot to get into today. Wes Walls will join the show later today doing TV work for the Minnesota Wild. So we'll preview that series. And I don't know if you all remember, but remember 2003? We might go down that memory road just for a bit as well.
Yeah, and I also want to ask Wes about the conversation we were having earlier in the week, which is who's that guy on this Minnesota Wild team
yeah.
that Canuck fans are going to be remembering as someone that played them tough or had that physical edge? And, you know, certainly one of the first names that comes to mind from that 03 series is Wes Walls. So who could be the Wes Walls of 2020 for this play-in series between the Canucks and the Wild? Although many of us in this part of the world are hoping that the result is a lot better for Vancouver this time around than it was back in 03.
Who was on the podium for the annoying guys back in 03? So it'd be Walls, Brad Brown?
Yeah, potentially. I'd have to look up the roster, to be honest, to have a good idea. Was Andrew
Darby
Burnett
Henderson
on those teams yet or not?
Yeah, he would have been there, yeah, for sure. Yeah, because we talked to him about that.
Just a few weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
Richard
Park.
I mean, Marian Gaborik was obviously great for them. Darby Hendrickson, Willie Mitchell was on those teams.
Yeah.
There's a few, but they weren't really a star-studded lineup. If you look down, I've got their roster from 2003 up now, and you know, other than Gaborik, there aren't really a ton of guys that jump off the page, but that was the system they played back then, right? They were that defensive, shut it down, find a way to grind it out team. And that maybe more than anything was the most frustrating part about the Canucks playing them.
650-650, if you want to chime in, if you got a question for Wes Walls, we'll drop it towards him as well. If you want to rehash 2003, we will talk to him as well about, you know, we keep doing this player prototype conversation. So, you know, he was that defensive checking center, so we'll talk to him about that coming up. I see a couple of Game of Take submissions already coming in. Keep them coming in at 650, 650, or you can go online at Sportsnet 650 and reply to the tweet there. Again, final day to get in. We've kept it pretty simple. Are you team playoffs or are you team draft? A good faction of the fan base wanting the – or shouldn't say wanting, but are willing to accept a chance at first overall pick. So where do you stand? Are you team draft or team playoffs? Reply to us at Sportsnet 650. But the big topic today and for the past couple of days has been the new CBA, the new economic landscape for the NHL teams. And once again, fans here are looking at potential doom when it comes to, you know, the cap structure for the Vancouver Canucks, and two big contracts are looming large. And last night on the program with myself and Andrew Walker, Elliot Friedman, Sportsnet NHL insider, joined the show. And, you know, we were talking about the future of what can happen with Pettersson and Hughes. And Elliot said this, we'll play this back. And I think we're each kind of taking something away, but when we're reflecting on how the Canucks, you know, move forward with this, they have a lot of options as far as, okay, bridge deals and whatnot, but how do the players try to approach it? Here's Elliot.
So you guys are wondering, are Pettersson and Hughes willing to do shorter term? My question is, and I have not spoken to either of them. I haven't spoken to their agents or anything like that. Why would you do this? This is just me. Why would they do that? all the guys getting paid now in this league are the guys in their second deals. And it, you can sign for 5 years like Matthews didn't get paid. Now, Matthews had a unique situation. But look what Marner got. Look what McDavid got. Look what Dreisaitl got on their second deals. Maybe the cap doesn't move that far. But do you think, like, if you were representing Quinn Hughes and Pettersson, would you say that's their problem or that's your problem? It's the Canucks' problem.
Yes, the team's problem.
The way those two guys are going, they're going to be, they deserve to be right up there. They're great players. They obviously, they got great attitudes, both of them. They're both winners. Like, to me, like, when I see those two guys, and I realize I'm not around them every day, but from what I see, like, if you told me I was going to be the GM of the Vancouver Canucks, and you said, like, your cornerstone guys are Pettersson and Hughes, I'm like, I look at those guys and I think I can win with them. Those are guys who have the right, not only are they great players, but they want to be even better. So they've got everything that you love that you can build around, right? And what's the, and I know it's a pandemic, and I know, but look, there's a guy in Kansas City who just signed for $500 million. So what that says to me is, if you've got the leverage, you're going to use it.
Elliot Friedman joined the program last night. You can check out the whole thing at sportsnet.ca/650. Batch, when you hear that, what are your first immediate takeaways?
Yeah, it's interesting because it seems to me, from a player's perspective, this conversation is about stability or maxing out your dollar amount. And, you know, I understand what Elliot's saying, but at the same time, with a flat cap for the next few years during a pandemic, you tend to think that these guys on long-term deals stand to make a lot more money if they wait. Now, they give up stability if they do that because, you know, you sign a bridge deal and, you know, not that I'm saying this is going to happen, but, you know, you could suffer a rash of injuries, not be the same player that, you know, we all think Pettersson and Hughes are going to be capable of being. And in 3 years when your bridge deal's up, suddenly you don't have that bargaining power to, you know, to bring in that big contract. But, you know, with the salary cap being flat, there's only a certain amount of money that general managers are going to be able to give up as a percentage of the current cap. But if you believe that coming out of this pandemic and over the next few years, the salary cap could go up and could potentially go up by quite a bit, as we initially thought it was going to before this whole COVID-19 era and, you know, the year 2020 being flipped on its head. Like, to me, that's where the money lies. Why would you want to sign a 7 or 8 year deal now at a lower cap hit when you could get a bridge deal, make some good money, and then in 2 or 3 years, then you can really cash in, assuming all goes well, when the salary cap goes up and the average salary goes up and the other top players around the league are making more money. But then again, if you value stability over squeezing every last dollar out of your career, and you know, it would be entirely reasonable to look at it and say, whatever way this goes, I'm going to make a lot of money. I would rather have the stability of a long-term deal. That could be the way that things go for these guys as well. But it just comes down to whether the Canucks are going to be able to pay both of them with their current salary cap issues. And that's not a guarantee, especially if they both want long-term deals and big money.
Of the two, I feel more confident. And again, this is just based on contractual trends across the league, not, you know, in speaking with the players or anything like that.
Yes. Yeah, this we should
of
we should
the
say,
two, yes.
This is all speculation. Yes. This is all our opinions.
This is us just talking. Yeah.
I have not personally spoken to either of these players or to their agents or anyone like that.
Of the two, I feel more confident that Elias Pettersson will get the long-term deal, cuz that's just the forward trend, that those players get the big deal. And I'm talking 10 million kind of scenario of that reality, which, you know, I know a lot of fans are looming large and looking at this and thinking, man, is it going to be 12 million? Is it going to be, you know, something like Austin Matthews got? Let's just say double digits, that Mitch Marner type money, okay? We can worry about the actual figure later.
Well, yeah, and just quickly, Bick, that's the thing that plays into it for me as well is, you know, Pettersson's a guy that's going to get double digits, but how high into double digits does he go? And how much of that is dependent upon when he's signing a contract like that? And, you know, like, for example, it's not going to be as high now as it could be in 3 years if the salary cap goes up. That's just a fact. It's, you know, roster management percentages, you know, certainly the Canucks are not in an ideal situation with money, but that's what these guys have to decide. And that's what it, you know, as I was saying, you know, does it make a big difference to you if it's 10 million or 12 million, or do you value the stability?
Okay, let's just say he gets the Jack Eichel contract. So, you know, Jack Eichel coming into he signed it in 2017, right before that season. So he would have had, you know, a couple of okay seasons and then, you know, 56, 57 points. Then he had a 64 point season. So let's say it's around that range, right?
Which was a 8-year, 10 million per deal. So 80 million right. over 8 years.
So
Eichel is currently in year two of that deal.
Yeah. So it's 13.3% of the cap, which by today would be 10.86 million. That feels reasonable.
Yeah. Well, reasonable in the sense that Pettersson deserves that kind of money, should get that kind of money for a player as important as him. You know, he is within his right to ask for a contract in and around that number. But then the question comes back on the other side of the argument, which is, can the Canucks afford to pay that for him and potentially something not quite that high in all likelihood, but close for Quinn Hughes?
Okay, see, there's the one that I'm kind of pushed back on, because what's the comparable right now in the league for defenseman contracts for Quinn Hughes? Because I think a lot of people are fearing this $10 million contract for his second contract. We haven't really seen that emerge. So you would be breaking the trend to give that contract out. He may want it, but remember, you know, he burned that 1 year, so he's lost some leverage in that scenario. But the Canucks kind of hold a lot of the cards in that Quinn Hughes contract more so than the Elias Pettersson one. And especially just based on the trends that go around the league of guys getting their second contracts. I guess the big fear would be like the Aaron Ekblad contract or the Provorov contract, and maybe it slots somewhere in that range. But by and large, like McAvoy got a bridge deal. Werenski got a bridge deal. Hanifin's was pretty cheap. Slavin, you know, around that 7%. So that's where I get I guess I'm less concerned about the fears with the cap. Is I'm not necessarily projecting that Quinn Hughes is going to get a $10 million contract.
No, but for him to get somewhere in the neighborhood of eight is realistic.
And so he's going to get the John Carlson contract?
Well, if it's going to be long-term, it's going to be that kind of, like the Ekblad deal you're talking about. If it's shorter term, you know, you're not exactly sure what that money could be. But one thing that is going to be very important with the Quinn Hughes contract, and if I'm the Canucks, I want to prioritize getting that deal signed, is that him and Cale Makar are both up at the same time. And if Makar's deal ends up being long-term big money, then that becomes a comparable for Quinn Hughes, because, you know, these two guys have been compared so closely to each other over the past season. And, you know, the Calder debate is, you know, continues to rage on. And it seems that the margin between the two of them is very thin. If the Avalanche go out and give Makar some long-term contract, then that puts the Canucks in a difficult spot. I mean, if it's a more team-friendly contract, it could be good for Vancouver. But with these young elite defensemen, I wonder if we are going to see this trend over the next few years follow that which we've seen for forwards. And because of that, I would want to be the first team to sign my young defenseman that's going to be up as a free agent. But no, you're right. The Ekblad deal or something in that neighborhood is probably the highest amount you're looking at for a guy like Quinn Hughes. And then a bridge deal, you know, you bring up Jacob Slavin is one of those guys that, you know, $5.5 million. Certainly, I think Hughes is going to be making more than that.
I mean, like Hedman did a bridge deal scenario, right? And we've seen that time and time again. And forwards don't really do that. Like, who's the forward that has done, like, elite forward has done the bridge deal? Is Kucherov the only one?
Could you put Braden Point in that conversation?
Probably not. Like, I agree. Like, I'm a big Braden Point fan, but I'm not sure if he necessarily falls in the same conversation we're talking about here.
Yeah, and he's a 3-year deal at just over $20 million over the three. But it's kind of hard to pinpoint. And, you know, you might be right. It could be that getting the bridge deal for Hughes and the long-term deal for Pettersson makes the most sense. But the other side of this is that, you know, as Elliot points out, we don't really know what these players want. From what Elliot was saying, he was thinking that these guys might want to sign their long-term deals now because they still have the leverage. The other side of things might be, hey, if I sign a 2 or 3 year deal, I could get more money after that. We won't really know which way these negotiations are going to go until they get underway.
Unsigned text here. COVID may have been the best thing to happen for the PD and Hughes contracts. I imagine this is in regards to how the Canucks would view it. Here's the other part is, there aren't a lot of teams that have made these big bets on contracts for long term from these elite players that have regretted it, right? Look at the McKinnon Barkov contracts, right? Yes, McDavid is expensive and Draisaitl, all those guys, but they are getting value. And on the back end of those deals, it's still beneficial to the teams to commit to the star elite players because they will make up the value later on in the contracts. And the point Ellie was making there is, okay, look, I know it's a pandemic and we're all dealing with COVID and, you know, the bank accounts are a bit tighter for the owners, but, you know, another professional sports team had no problem giving out $500 million earlier this week. So if teams wanted to find ways to commit $80 million over the next 8 years, they'll find a way to do it.
No, and don't get me wrong, from a Canucks team perspective, assuming you can afford it, the ideal decision right now is to get these guys under long-term contracts because you're only going to have to pay them more if you bridge them in all likelihood, unless things go very wrong for the player, in which case that's a scenario you don't even want to entertain at all. You want these guys to be elite for a long time. If the Canucks can afford it, you know, it would be the absolute best decision for them to both sign Pettersson and Hughes to max term deals and say, okay, you know, we can put that to the side. We don't have to worry about it for almost a decade. There are two guys, they're locked in. But that's where a lot of this fear and a lot of the debate on social media and Canuck Twitter happens right now is, okay, so where do you think that Hughes number comes in if it's a max term deal? Like, what conversation are we having about AAV for Quinn Hughes on 8 years?
Okay, let's say it's like
7.5-8 million. Is that fair? Is that too much?
I still feel like that's like 9% of the cap would be like 7.34% or 7.3 million, which would, you know, break a lot of the markers that other guys have set. So that's kind of what I'm looking at.
Okay, so $7.5 million somewhere in there. Pettersson, we're talking close to $11 million. So, you know, $18-19 million that you're going to tie up in these two guys, which, you know, I'm not saying they don't deserve it. They absolutely do. And if you could get those two guys under contract long term for something around those numbers at the end of those deals, those are going to look really good, you would assume, with the salary cap going up and things like that. But that's what the fear comes in is, you know, can the Canucks afford to add $19 million to their payroll right now? And unless they move heaven and earth, they can't do it. So,
well, to be fair,
that's where people talk about cap hell, is that the
to
ideal
be fair,
situation
that's 2 years from now.
That's true. Like, so there's lots of time to move that
right
heaven
now,
and earth.
Yeah. Like as it stands right now, there's roughly $38 million, I think a bit more, for that year when the contract has come in. So that's half of it gone. I get that. But there is space for when those contracts are due. It's how do you navigate everything in between then? So the space will be there and is there to accomplish that. If in a scenario where we're talking about it's two landmark long-term deals. Bick Nizar, Brendan Batchelor, your thoughts always welcome. 650, 650. Keep those questions coming. Go in for Richmond. In my NHL 20 simulation, Quinn wanted 10.5, and it was a bargain, I tell you. PD wanted 14. He had to pound sand. Business, you know. keep the your thoughts coming in. 650, 650.
One quick thing for me, though, Bick, and you're right that a lot of that money comes off the books, but at the same time, you know, those are guys that you have to replace that are coming off the books too. So, you know, Jacob Markstrom is up. You assume that you're adding his money to that conversation too. If you're going to lose a guy like Chris Tanev, you've got to find a top four defenseman somewhere else. You know,
right? But people have been trying to trade Brandon Sutter for 3 years. His contract's coming off the books.
Yeah. So
Alex Edler, we'll see where he is. That obviously that's very important, but like the money's there and you allocate your money to the star players first and then figure out the rest.
Yeah, certainly. And so, yes, it's unfair. I'll walk back what I said a little bit. It's unfair to characterize it as something they cannot do, but you know what they risk being in a situation of doing is signing those deals and then turning around and going, okay, we've got to fill out the rest of our roster and, oh, we don't have very much to do that. And, you know, that's where you need your pipeline to come through and you've got to have other young players on cheap deals, whether that's like Niels Höglander or Vasily Podkolzin coming through to help you fill out your roster. So it's not impossible for them to do, but it's not going to be easy either. Like it's not fair to characterize it and say, oh, Sutter's coming off the books.
Pierce books.
Edler's coming off the books. They've got tons of money. They can sign these guys. They'll be fine. Because if all those guys come off the books and that money gets filled up with two players, you still have to ice the rest of your roster and be competitive throughout your lineup. And that's something that the Toronto Maple Leafs have done here, where they've given a ton of money to their top guys. And, you know, it's going to be difficult for them, I think, over the next few years, you know, managing all those contracts at the same time while having a competitive roster all the way through the lineup.
Which is why we've, you know, seriously underscored the debate on the contracts like Jake Virtanen now and Chris Tanev now, because its impact is felt in 2 years. That's where the important part comes in. And, you know, for those that have advocated, okay, it's maybe time to move off of those guys. And can you replenish the rest of your roster or reallocate, you know, that asset elsewhere on your roster? That's where that desire comes from in that regard. 650, 650. We'll try to get to a couple more of your questions, but we didn't want to pitch one thing out there. Cause we've started to see the start times for these games coming up, both the Bob Father and Emily Kaplan reporting of when the games will be going, both in Toronto and Edmonton. One thing that's going to be curious to, because my initial reaction to all this is I'm like, oh man, I can't wait to sit down and watch all the games for all the hours of the day. And obviously we'll be working, but it'll feel like a World Cup. But at the same time, you know, it's this fandom where we've been without sports. You want to watch it with all your friends and all of that. How are you approaching viewing habits for this projected schedule?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting because you're right. We look at the start times and, you know, games are going to be starting local time in each of the two hub cities. We expect at noon, 4 o'clock and 8. So a noon game in Toronto, 4 o'clock, 8 o'clock also in Toronto, noon, 4 and 8 in Edmonton, which lines up absolutely perfectly if you want to spend the first 2 weeks of August doing absolutely nothing but watching hockey, because in Vancouver, local time, that means a game at 9 a.m., 11 a.m., 1 p.m., 3 p.m., 5 p.m., 7 p.m. So you've got six games back to back to back to back to back to back all day long.
But you're right. Hook it into my veins.
Exactly. But so what's your setup going to be? Because normally Canuck playoff games, people get together, you host a party at your house, or you go out to a local establishment and gather together, or, you know, we've had public viewing parties in the city in the past. So what's your plan? How are you going to try and get that same playoff feel while still here? It is social distance central, so we have to advocate. You've got to social distance. You've got to be safe. Certainly you could have small, socially distant gatherings to watch games, but you're not going to be having big parties or anything like you might have experienced in past years. So what are you going to do to get that playoff feel and to get really into the games? What do you need for your viewing experience to make this feel like the Stanley Cup playoffs, even though it's 2020 and we're going through COVID-19?
So send us your thoughts, 650-650. Wes Walls coming up, former Minnesota Wild legend. We will talk to him in just a couple of minutes here on Social Distance Central on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
Don't sweat the technique.
Social Distance Central, Vic Nizar, Brendan Batchelor, here on the home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Your thoughts coming in, 650, 650. Also, heads up, Game of Takes. I got a couple coming in here. Your last chance to get in. We will choose our competitor who's going to take on Nick Dragan later on today. So if you want to reply, if you've wanted to get into Game of Takes, you're thinking, how do I get in? It's pretty simple. Just head to Twitter, reply to us at Sportsnet 650, at Batch Hockey, or at Vic 650, and we will reach out to you. And you could be hear your take tomorrow on our airwaves for what is this, week 7 of Game of Takes? It's flown by.
Has it really been 7 weeks that we've been doing this show?
6 or 7? Yeah, I think it's 7.
Wow, it has flown by. You're right. And potentially our most divisive topic on Game of Takes yet this week, with team win or team first overall pick, I guess we could call it.
I'm trying to say team tank.
But that's what people call it, though.
But I've made the point that the ones that are saying team tank just need a better marketer. Like, say team draft, right? Because, like, again, the philosophy makes sense of having, like, high picks. Like, it makes sense. And I understand what the people are saying. It's just when you say tank, it sounds way more nefarious than what you're actually advocating. And so I think that's why people push back.
Yeah, it's got a negative connotation. That's
true.
Team draft versus team win. What do you want to see for the Canucks going into this series with the Minnesota Wild? Of course, if they lose, they have a 12.5% chance at the first overall pick in this year's NHL entry draft, potentially a franchise-altering player, or you could see them play actual Stanley Cup playoff games for the first time in 5 years.
We were also asking you, what's your setup going to be once the playoffs start? There's going to be a whole lot of games on TV, 6 per day.
Here's a good text in from Gurinder, who says, thinking I'll buy a fridge for my basement just to keep the beer cold. I'll be all alone in front of my 52-inch 4K TV. No wife or kids allowed in the basement. Go Canucks, go.
Well, you should make it a family affair, Gurinder. Come on.
You want to be raising little hockey fans, don't you?
Yes.
You got to get them involved.
Absolutely. Joey in Richmond, I'm going to stream the games on my work computer with my Sportsnet TV account. Whilst bumping Sportsnet 650 on the AM dial simultaneously. I like a whilst and simultaneously in the same sentence. That's really good. Then I'm going to go home, have a nice pink Whitney, and discuss the day's events on my Baron Fantasy Hockey group chats. That's a rough one. Like, we got to figure out playoff pools. Do play-in rounds count for playoff pools? Like, that's going to be tough.
Yeah, we got to figure this out, too, because for my league, for example, the hockey pool that I'm in, there's a pot of money that was supposed to be handed out to the regular season winner that now is just sitting there. And so that money is being pushed into the playoff pool. So the stakes have never been higher for my group anyway, in terms of trying to figure out the playoffs. And that's the thing that I love about playoff pools, is it's not just picking the best players or the guys that are going to produce most, like in the regular season. You've got to pick the best players on the teams that actually go far. And, you know, let's say someone from the play-in round that no one expects, like the Florida Panthers or the New York Islanders or someone like that, go on a deep run in the playoffs. If you've got Matt Barzal or Jonathan Huberdeau, you might be winning your hockey pool just based on that fact. So there's a lot more that goes into it, and I love playoff pools. I probably love them more than regular season pools, to be honest.
Let's talk about a man who, or talk to a man that had much success in a playoff run, also against the Vancouver Canucks. He of 600 plus NHL games, longtime Minnesota Wild. He is Wes Walls. Wes, when we do these interviews with former players that tortured the Vancouver Canucks, we're always worried what the reaction will be, but some Lethbridge love for you in our text inbox. Some people saying a Lethbridge transplant here in Vancouver. He was the king with the Hurricanes. So fans are thrilled to hear from you, Wes.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. I know, obviously, the last time in the Wild and Canucks hooked up in 03, that was a few years ago. And we bought a place out in 1998 on the Shuswap Lake. My wife and I are originally from Calgary. So we spent a lot of our summers in the Kamloops area out here in the Shuswap. And my neighbors out here just started talking to me a couple, 3 years ago. We didn't talk for many, many years. They weren't very happy with me in the Wild knocking off the Canucks. But that was an interesting time and a kind of a crazy series as well.
What do you remember about that series too? Because we were talking about just, you know, it felt like, you know, the Canucks have had some rivalries obviously against the Avalanche and the Wings in that area. But like my memory of that series is it felt like the first one where it was two equals with a lot of hate in that series.
Well, there was, I've been looking back at some of the things that happened in 03 because I figured at some point I'd probably be asked a few questions about what went on. And to be honest with you, before the playoffs even started, the last day of the regular season, there was a really, really good chance that we were actually going to play the Canucks in the first round. And we weren't really that excited about playing the Canucks in the first round just because of the season that they had and the kind of talent that they had. And I believe all they had to do in game 82 was win a home game against the Los Angeles Kings, who were putrid and really had a really tough year. And I think they lost 2-0 at home, an afternoon game or something like that. And then we ended up hooking the Colorado Avalanche in the first round. So, you know, it was a crazy series back then. We went through kind of a war before we got to the Canucks, and being down 3-1 against Peter Forsberg, Joe Sakic, and Patrick Waugh and all those guys up there. I mean, that was amazing kind of what we did even against the Colorado Avalanche in 03, coming back from down 3-1. And then, to be able to do that twice in a row against a Vancouver Canuck team that was just, they were loaded. They had a great, great team. And we were fortunate to get past them. You know, if you look back at the series and how we were able to get past them, I think goaltending played a really important role. Dan Cloutier, I don't think he had a great series, that series in particular. And Dwayne Rolison really played well for us. And, we kind of stuck to the game plan and what we were all about. We knew we couldn't really veer from what got us to where we were at that point. We just didn't have as much high-end talent as far as scoring that the other teams did. So we knew that we had to buckle down defensively and hope and pray that some of the other teams, got frustrated and took silly penalties. And as long as we stayed focused, we'd give ourselves at least a chance to win some games in the series. And then we were fortunate enough, obviously, to win game 7 in Vancouver, which is very exciting if you're a Wild fan. And if you're a Vancouver Canuck fan, not very exciting.
Wes, what do you remember about the feeling amongst your group at that point where you're down 3-1 to the Canucks? Because you're right, a lot of Vancouver fans might forget that you guys had already done that against the Colorado Avalanche and you win game 7 in overtime. And in some ways it must have felt like, oh no, here we go again. We're down 3-1 to another good team. But then at the same time, was there a sense of, hey, we've done this before, we can do it again?
Guys, we were playing with house money going into the playoffs. Before the Colorado series, I remember 10 national pundits in North America, Canada, U.S. I think out of the 10 pundits, one person said that we were going to win one game, 4-1, we would lose against the Colorado Avalanche, and we were able to beat them. Not many people gave us much of an opportunity to win many games, and we had a group that was much more confident in our ability than anybody ever knew. I think even against Colorado and even Vancouver that year, I know they had some high-end talent, but people forget that we had one of the fastest teams probably in the Western Conference that year. And you know, being down 3-1 obviously was not ideal. It's not the situation we wanted to be in. We knew we were playing a great team, but I just remember coming back into Vancouver for Game 5, and I believe we won that game pretty handily. And I just don't remember before the game thinking to myself, you know, we have to win this game. I mean, obviously we've got our backs against the wall. We do have to win, but we just never felt the pressure in our locker room. Just because no one gave us any chance to do anything in the playoffs. We were a Jacques Lemaire team, great defensively, blah, blah, blah. They play the trap in the neutral zone. Not an exciting team to watch. And you know, the part that people don't really understand about Jacques Lemaire, and I played for him for 8 years. Yes, we were solid defensively and through the neutral zone, but if you didn't make plays with the pucks offensively when you had opportunities, he didn't just love you dumping the puck in and go giving it back to the other team. He would get pissed off many times if we had opportunities to make plays. And I think that's one of the things that sometimes gets lost in the traffic whenever you talk about the Jacques Lemaire teams. But, you know, the other thing that really sticks out to me in that series, is I think Jacques Lemaire was probably the most important person in that series for the Minnesota Wild, getting the matchups that we needed and wanted, especially in Vancouver and especially in Colorado. You know, changing on the fly, trying to get guys on and off the ice. I spent a lot of time playing against Morrison's line with Bertuzzi and Naslin, even in Vancouver when we didn't get last change. I did a lot of taking the faceoffs and jumping on and off the ice. But so I think the game plan that we had to try to give ourselves a chance was very, very important. And Jacques Lemaire, in my estimation, was probably one of the most important people we had in our organization just for us to allow us to have that kind of run we had back in 03.
And when you look at the playoff series that we're going to see, or the play-in series that we're going to see here this year between the Canucks and the Wild, what do you expect from it? Obviously, you cover the Wild, so you've got that Minnesota perspective on what the Canucks might bring. And you know, maybe the best way for Minnesota to have success against Vancouver in terms of the style of the games.
Well, it's going to be really interesting, and I'm sure all the fans all over North America are kind of curious just to see how this is all going to play out. I mean, having four weeks off or months off as a professional hockey player, and then jumping into playoff hockey. I don't care if there's not any fans in the stands. I mean, the guys know what's at stake, and that's getting your name on the Stanley Cup and getting a Stanley Cup ring. Jumping into this is going to be really weird. I don't know what to expect, to be perfectly honest with you. And being perfectly candid with your audience and the people that are listening right now, I really do think with the Canucks having a younger team, I do think that they have the advantage going into this short 5-game series, having a younger group. I can just tell, the reason I say this is just from my own experience of, you know, I was a younger player when I played in the National Hockey League, but I was also a 37-year-old player. And the Minnesota Wild have guys like Ryan Suter, who's 35, 36, Mikko Koivu's 37, Eric Staal's 35, they got older forwards up front. And if it's going to take these guys, you know, a week or 10 days to get their legs underneath them, I mean, it's going to be over fast. So I do believe that the Vancouver Canucks have that advantage of being younger. Again, I don't know how it's going to play out. That's just me with my experience. Again, we have to all wait and see how this plays out. And the other X factor that the Canucks have that is by far the most important thing if you ever want to have playoff success is goaltending. And Markstrom has been is quietly one of the best goalies in the National Hockey League. And I'm not sure the Minnesota fan base really recognizes how good this guy really, really is. And, you know, the Minnesota Wild goaltending situation, Devan Dubnyk had struggled a little bit over the last 10 games and basically lost his number one position to backup goalie Alex Stalock, who actually played outstanding over the last probably 6 weeks of the season before we got cut off with COVID. But so we don't know who's going to be the starting goalie coming into that Vancouver series from the Minnesota Wild standpoint. They've got a kid in the minors, Kaapo Kähkönen, as well, a Finnish goalie that's going to be in the mix as well. And don't think that he's not in the mix, especially if the Wild goaltending is not where it needs to be in Game 1 and Game 2. This kid won the goalie of the year down in the American Hockey League and looks to me like he might be the goalie of the future for the Minnesota Wild.
Wes Walls joining us here on Sportsnet 650. We were talking about this earlier in the week on our show here, Wes, but you know, you look back at some of the classic playoff series from a Vancouver perspective, and there were always guys on the other side that fans here in Vancouver grew to hate because of their effectiveness. You know, you talked about not talking to your neighbors for many years after getting a house in the Shuswap. So you know that very well as well. If there's one guy on this Minnesota Wild team that Canuck fans are going to hate after this series, who's it going to be?
Huh, that's an excellent question. Just off the top of my head right now, I mean, Kevin Fiala is quietly been in a, you know, I don't know if your fan base out here in British Columbia know exactly what's been going on, but Kevin Fiala has scored 14 goals in his last 18 games, and the way he was playing before the break was he was playing like a superstar. He had the Wild on his back offensively. But I think the one guy that that I think Vancouver Canuck fans are going to hate before the end of the series is Marcus Foligno. He's a hard-nosed third line winger, really big guy, kind of a quiet leader. I know we got some, you know, the Zach Parise's, Ryan Suter's, Mikko Koivu's in the locker room, but Marcus Foligno, when he gets up and talks in the locker room, is not very vocal, but when he stands up every once in a while, I mean, he's a quiet leader and he hits everything that moves. And I think, you know, with the Canucks and the speed and their transition game and what they can do offensively, especially with, Quinn Hughes on the back end playing like a rover, I think being physical, Elias Pettersson as well, just trying to be as physical as you possibly can and getting as many body contact on these type of players you can is going to be important for the Wild, but it's easier said than done just the way these guys move. So I would say before the end of the series is over, regardless of who wins, Marcus Foligno will be somebody that the Vancouver Canucks fans will learn to hate.
Listening to Sportsnet 650, Bick Nizar and Brendan Batchelor talking to longtime NHLer Wes Walls, and now TV analyst for the Minnesota Wild. Wes, one of the things we're doing during the stoppage is, you know, we don't have games to talk about, but we love talking to older players. We're kind of just finding player prototypes. And so we invite you to be as nerdy as possible in this, but you know, we look at you and say, okay, a phenomenal checking center in your time. And one of the things we always say about offensive players is the game just comes to them, right? The puck just finds them. We don't always say that about defensive players because you know, they're always in the right spot. Do you feel like defense gets labeled as like you're chasing the play and you make a play, or how did you approach it? Did you let the puck kind of come to you in an area, or were do we kind of mislabel how defense is played at times?
You know what? It's you know, not many people know about my 600 games in the National Hockey League. I played 4 years over in Switzerland as well, too, over and above those 600 games. And when you look back at my career, the first 5 years of my career in the NHL being up and down, like if anybody was ever on the ice on the opposition's club that had scored more than 30 goals in an NHL season, I had to come off the ice. So I was never looked at as a defensive player. And when Jacques Lemaire came in, he said to me after about 4 or 5 days of training camp that this is what he wanted to do with me because he thought my skating ability, my hockey sense, he felt like maybe that was an opportunity to be a checking center. And he had always had one, you know, on any of the teams that he had played with before. So I learned so much about how to play proper defensively and be in good position. And, you know, when I had this conversation with Jock after our first training camp, I just remember calling my wife on the drive home and saying, Jacques Lemaire just said to me, he goes, he didn't care if I scored 3 goals all year. I just want to make sure that when we leave the building 5-on-5, that whoever you're playing against, Wes, we play them straight up. And what ended up happening is I was actually a plus player in almost all the seasons I played with the Minnesota Wild just because the offensive players take a lot of chances. And if you look at a lot of the best defensive players that have ever played this game, they were all great offensive players at junior and U.S. college, wherever they came from. So they know how the mentality of a top scorer in the National Hockey League, how they think. And we know as players, because there's so much pressure on those guys to score and put up numbers and justify their contracts, their $5, $6, $7, $8 million deals, that they will take chances offensively. And, you know, Jock explained that to me. It didn't take me long really to figure out that if I was in good positions defensively all over the ice, that when loose pucks popped out and they had taken some chances and had maybe 3 forwards down below the goal lines, it was opportunity for me to try to score off the rush. with my wingers. And most of my goals in, that I scored, you know, in the 7-8 years I played for Jacques Lemaire were off of the rush just from the other opposition, whoever line you were playing against, was taking so many chances offensively. So I think a lot of the best checkers that have ever played this game were also great scorers in junior, so they understand the psyche and the mentality of the offensive player. And to be great defensively now compared to 20 years ago, and I was always a pretty good skater, you have to be able to skate today to be a great defensive player. But you're seeing less and less of the checking line centers like that I was under Jacques Lemaire in the league now, just because there's not as many matchups. You just don't see it as often as you used to. But so obviously those are some of the skills that you need to develop if you want to be a great checking center around the National Hockey League.
Were there like markers that you looked for on the ice? Like, you know, if you're back checking, would you say, okay, I've got to get to this post, and I know that's where the offensive player is trying to take the puck into those high danger areas, if I can cut that off? Or do you try to just, you know, be a nuisance more so than anything?
Well, I mean, so I was basically not allowed to forecheck. Like I was the centerman, and I was the high guy all the time. So, I mean, I was able to get in the forecheck a little bit, and some of the wingers that I played with from time to time, they'd want me to get involved on the forecheck and get engaged a little bit more. But I had to explain it with whoever I played with, whether it was Marian Gaborik or Brian Rolston or Antti Laaksonen, that I just came from playing over in Switzerland for 4 years, and I was up and down the minors the first 6 years of my career. I kind of like playing the National Hockey League right now, so I'm going to do exactly what my coach tells me to do. And it didn't take me long to learn that if I was the high guy in the offensive zone and I didn't expend a whole lot of energy, every time I come into my own zone, playing against Todd Bertuzzi, Marcus Naslin, Morrison, guys like that, I always had a full tank of gas, always. And I know the first half of the year, sometimes I get caught in the forecheck, and there's nothing worse than coming into your zone against the best players in the world, knowing you only have a half a tank of gas to get through that shift. So those are some of the type of things that I definitely learned. When we played for the Wild, we would not allow teams to score off the rush. We'd kind of pack it in, and then we communicated as best we could to try to get out on top of people as quick as we could. So we packed it in, and once we got, they didn't score off the rush, we knew that we were playing against a lot of the best players and teams in the world, that we were going to spend some time in our offensive zone or in the defensive zone. But we were comfortable as a team being in our own zone, knowing that even if we spend an extra 20, 30 seconds down here, they're not going to get anything to the inside. It's just a matter of time. And if they do, we had decent goaltending. So we kept a lot of the play to the outside guys, and we let our goaltenders make the first save and kind of just get out of there. But you're asking me individually, one of the things I learned from Jacques Lemaire was making sure that I came in my own zone with a full tank, because I still remember him saying to me, "You're playing against the best players in the world, son. There's a good chance you might be in your own zone for a long time." So I always remember.
He's a longtime NHLer of 600 plus games, Wes Walls. Wes, I'm sure we'll talk to you soon as we get ready for this Vancouver Minnesota series. Should be a lot of fun. Thanks for the time today.
It's gonna be a great series, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Take care. We got to run here. Reach Deep on the way. Randy Janda and Dan Riccio. It's Wednesday, so you know Shane O'Brien is coming up soon on Reach Deep. Batch, thank you very much. Keep tuned in on Sportsnet 650, the home of the Canucks. Sportsnet 650.